morning. We're delighted to welcome with us Appleton Xavier High School. And would the students please stand?
Good-looking group.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for standing. You may be seated. So here, we have a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students across the state to come and learn about the judicial branch of government by attending an oral argument and then meeting with a justice assigned for meeting with students that day. The students get material about the case that is scheduled for oral argument. And the discussion after this second case is about the procedures the court uses in taking a case, deciding a case, and issuing opinions in the case. The discussion is not about the substantive issues in the case. Everyone is invited, even if you're not a student, to attend that session. Now that we've met the students from Appleton, even for a short time, I shall introduce the justices of the court. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robensack. And you will meet with Justice Robensack after this second case. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to Justice Bradley's immediate right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right is Justice Justice Annette
Ziegler.
Exactly, Justice Annette Ziegler. All right. With those introductions badly made, I'll call our second case, which is 2013 AP 545, Bank of New York versus Shirley T. Carson. Arguing on behalf of the Bank of New York is Valerie Bailey Rein. And arguing on behalf of legal action, on behalf of Ms. Carson is legal action of Wisconsin, April Hartman. Ms. Rein has 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Hartman has 30 minutes. You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Valerie Bailey Rein, and with me is Catherine Perhatch, my partner. We represent the appellant, the Bank of New York Mellon S. Trustee. This case is a very interesting case, but I don't think it accomplished what the respondent is trying to do. She is trying to read into the foreclosure statutes a requirement that lenders immediately upon a 5-week period sell the property after the abandonment period is over. In addition, it appears that implicit in that requirement would also be a requirement that the lender not only sell the property but also buy it at the sheriff's sale. And the reason for this is to try to accomplish what we all say is a big problem in Milwaukee and other places, neighborhood blight. I don't think anybody will disagree that that is a issue, but the problem is that the solution that they're suggesting is not found in the statutes and is something that the legislation has to take up if, in fact, that there is a problem and if there is an alternative resolution.
So
What I hear you saying is that there are two requirements that Ms. Carson wants. One, that the mortgagee sell, and two, that the mortgagee buy.
Correct.
And, could you take one requiring the mortgagee to sell without taking the second that the mortgagee must buy?
You can, because they are two different statutes.
Right.
The problem, though, is if you find that the abandonment statute requires a sale, you are going to have to also require a sale anytime a deficiency is waived, both in the commercial context and in the home context, even if the people are still in the property, because the language is identical.
You're talking about 846-102 and 846-103, and are you relying on the prior case that was done here, namely Mattson?
That case discussed it, but I'm also relying on the language of the statutes and that with statutory interpretation where it says that if the same term is used throughout a chapter of the statutes, it's a reasonable deduction that the legislature intended that the term possess identical meaning each time it appears. That's in Bank Mutual versus S.J. Boyer Construction, a recent 2010 case. So the language is identical. Now, you might ask a logical question is, well, the statutes also talk about may sell. You may sell at a foreclosure sale in 12 months, or you may sell in 6 months. The reason for the difference in the language, the may and the shall relate to the redemption period. When you have a may be held until the expiration of 6 months, there is a provision that allows you to shorten that time. But if you do shorten that time, then you must or shall hold it for the full redemption period. So I think that is the logical reading of the chapter as a whole, and all statutes or chapters should be read in context with each other. For instance, in 846.01, it says, a judgment of foreclosure and sale shall not be entered until 20 days after the list pendants is filed. What that, to me, says is you have 20 days. You have to wait until you can get your judgment. You shall wait that 20 days. And so that's consistent with the abandonment statute that says you shall wait 5 weeks before you can get your judgment. In 846.101, it states that if you want to waive the deficiency, you shall wait 6 months. But if you don't, then you may foreclose after 12 months. So the may and shall are both related to the redemption period. One allows you to shorten it. When they say shall, they mean you can't. And that goes back to the common law history in Wisconsin that favors redemption periods since 1850, Bryan versus May, 2 Chandler 103. And that was cited in the Griswold case at 215 Wissecond at 475. Redemption periods have always been favored in Wisconsin. And the point of that is to allow people the opportunity to redeem their property, not to force the seller to sell the property, but to allow them to redeem their property. If there is an issue with requiring a sale, and if the court finds that you have to require a sale, then you're going to have the same problem with both the commercial context and the homestead context and the apartment context. They are going to be required to be sold very quickly, which cuts against the...
Of course, that provision is not before us, and 846.103 has been before the Court of Appeals, and they've had a series of cases that interpret it. Now, in terms of shall or may, how do you read the Court of Appeals decision? Does that require the trial court to order the sale if the trial court finds that there's been abandonment here?
I believe that's the intent of the Court of Appeals.
That
decision.
It's required to sell.
It's required
well,
to sell.
Well, I found that the briefs, both yours and Ms. Carson's, interpreted differently in different places. I think sometimes you interpret that the trial, when I say you, both parties, interpret the Court of Appeals to say the trial court finds abandonment, it may order a sale, and that it's discretionary on ordering a sale, and that this foreclosure is an equitable matter, and they have therefore balanced equities. At other times, I found the briefs, and when I read the Court of Appeals decision, I read it to require a sale on the words shall. So you say you read it to mean the trial court must order a sale if there's abandonment, right?
That's the way I read it, Your Honor.
Okay, but 846.103 is not an abandonment statute, is it?
Right, but the language is consistent, and so...
But that's a big difference, isn't it?
Not really, because the abandoned statute was changed in 2012 from 2 months to 5 weeks. But the underlying language in the statute, shall, is much older. It's back from 77 or 73. And so I think what they did is when they put in the shortening the redemption period for the commercial apartment in the homestead, they took that language from abandonment because it's consistent with the idea that you can't reduce that redemption period anymore. You're already getting the benefit of a reduced redemption period.
They put in a second subsection about the city, or community, I should say, maybe it would be better, coming in and having a say about abandonment, right?
They did, and I think that was designed to try to help speed up the process, that lenders, to the extent that they wanted to get the property and sold quicker, that was designed to help speed up that process.
How did it do that?
Well, because at the time, the lender is not in possession of the property. The city is the ones who are experiencing maybe the service calls, the sidewalk's not shoveled, it's bored up, so that they are an alternative person to come in and to provide testimony because the bank isn't going to be able to say unless they go out and physically inspect it, but the city obviously has some knowledge of it, and that does help speed up if the fact that the property could be sold. I'm not disagreeing that the change in the statute was designed to try to help speed up the process and help blight. I'm just saying that the legislator did not change the specific languages that was in there before, and one would assume that if they really wanted to force a sale, they would have cleared that up and made sure that it was obvious that they had to sell it.
Well, since they changed the statute by putting in subsection 2, now the context of that statute has changed, so that's an argument on context, which you agree on, is a statutory interpretation issue.
Right, and it was designed to try to move these processes quicker through the process, but again, it was not contemplated, if you look at the statutes together, that a lender has to be forced to take the property.
Where does it say that? You're losing me on that argument. What statute requires the lender to buy?
There is no statute that requires the lender to buy.
Why does the lender have to buy because there's a sale? Can't it just go to the highest bidder and maybe the lender won't get paid in full, but property's getting worth less and less as it's getting trashed sitting there anyway?
The problem, you're right, it would go to whoever would bid on it. The problem with this property in this situation is when you've got property taxes are past due, you've got in this case, during the redemption period, whether it was 3 months or 5 weeks, the garage was, vandals broke in and burned the garage. So no one's going to bid on the property. If the lender doesn't bid on the property, and they're not required to, no one gets the property. We're in the same situation.
I mean, but, it just is a failed sale then. I mean, it's been a long time since I've sold property that had a judgment against it, either personal property or real estate. And I don't ever remember a failed sale, but sometimes you get bids that are very, very low. But if someone would buy it, even for a low price, it would begin to, they'd have to want to rehabilitate it or do something, or they wouldn't have bought it.
Right. I think what happened is with the economic downturn of 2008, there more and more, nobody buys these properties. The amicus brief itself says that
the value of the property is what? Less than the mortgage, outstanding mortgage? Is that why no one buys them?
No, it's in this case, the city of Milwaukee, I looked up this week, the real estate taxes on this are $21,000. The value of the property is roughly about $19,000. So the city, you buy it subject to the taxes. So it's
past taxes.
Past taxes, yes. So the taxes, economically, it doesn't make sense because the city steps in ahead of us. No one's going to buy it.
But the city could work a deal. If they want to get these properties moving so that they're not continually trashed, they can work a deal and not take the full amount of the taxes for, I mean, there are things that could be done if there were a buyer that wanted the property. I mean, otherwise, what you're saying is until this thing crumbles into the earth, it's just going to sit there. I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's just the fate of cities like Milwaukee that have areas that are like this, but that's so disheartening.
The amicus brief said 4,900 properties are abandoned. Of that, 400 are in foreclosure. So even if you ordered every one of those 400 in foreclosure to sell the property and say you get 20% bids on it, the rest you don't, you still have the same problem. It is a problem, but I don't think ordering lenders to sell properties that no one wants to bid does anything other than it continues to delay the process, additional expense on the lender, and at the end of the day, you're back at the same point.
Well, it may be that banks are going to want to start looking at, do they really want to foreclose on these properties? I mean, it's not so different than when you worry about, is there a gas station that used to be on this site and get an environmental impact statement, then decide as a bank, oh, no, we're going to work out some other kind of deal because we don't want to take this property back.
And that is exactly what happened when I first started practicing law, is that we had the environmental contamination issues. Lenders would start the foreclosure process, get the judgment. No one said you had to go to sale. What happened was that they would try to get a receiver appointed, see if there was any interest in the property. If there wasn't, then they would satisfy their judgment, release the list pendants, release the mortgage, which is, in essence, what occurred here.
They didn't actually do that. That's a difference from Mattson, isn't it?
They did not. They released the list pendants, and we found out very recently that they had, in fact, satisfied the mortgage.
When?
That was done in 2012, and it was sent to Mrs. Carson at her new address. It's not in the record until my colleague suggested doing a title report. It wasn't in the record, and so I can't cite to any particular, but it's a matter of public record in the Register of Deeds. So,
if the bank would buy it even for a dollar or $2, then it becomes the owner, right?
It correct.
Be the owner. And then it's required to maintain, it's required to pay the taxes, et cetera. That's the problem,
right?
Right? That's
yep.
why it doesn't want to be forced to sell. And what happens when it is in foreclosure, but that there is no sale, is that Ms. Carson, the mortgagor, then has title, and it and she has to maintain the property, and she has to pay the taxes. And there's a statute that says she can stay, but she did abandon it. Now, as a result of that, what can you said this has to play out. How does it play out? It plays out. She's the owner. She has to maintain. She can't afford it. She's paying part of the fines or forfeitures that the city is has done. The property is valued at less than the mortgage plus taxes and any other liens on it. So no one's going to buy it. I mean, this is the bank isn't going to buy it. No one else is going to buy it. She can't maintain it. So the building is in bad repair. It's the scene of crime and blight on the neighborhood. So it finally falls down, maybe injures someone. I don't know if she's retained insurance. And then what happens to it?
Well, what's happening here, based on the neighborhood website for the city of Milwaukee, is they're going to raise this property. That'll solve the issue. I'm not saying it is.
Don't they have to go through proceedings to raise it?
They have already done a raise order. They had 30 days to appeal. No one's appealed. So it will get raised.
So what the bank has done and what Ms. Carson has done, it has placed the burden on the city of Milwaukee and all of its taxpayers.
That's what happens when you have properties that are in essence walked away by the person who owns the property, and the lenders have determined, in addition, the lender loaned $50,000 on this property, so the cost, if they were forced to sell the property and forced to buy the property, they would have the $50,000 or $52,000 that they loaned in 2007, plus the past due taxes of $21,000, probably another additional $10,000 for the raising fees, and the maintenance costs. I think the net effect of that, and that's why I think this has to be addressed by the legislature, is lenders would consider those issues in determining either whether to lend or the interest rates they charge, because if they're going to be the, in essence, the guarantor of their borrower's behavior, for instance, like the polluted gas station, if they know that if they lend to a gas station and it has pollution and the gas station can abandon the property and force them to sell and buy it, that's going to raise their costs. So the problem here, too, is we're trying to decide a very serious issue on the base of one case instead of having the legislation decided, listening to the competing interests and trying to come up with a solution.
Well, the court's going to have to decide it for one side or the other. The court decides it for the bank, it's interpreted the statute. The court decides it for Ms. Carson, it's interpreted the statute. So the court has to decide it. It doesn't throw up its hands and say, hey, go across to the West Wing or the South Wing and get the legislature to answer it, right? So the court has to decide the issue regardless. Now, how would the legislature repair this, in your opinion?
Well, and I see my warning light on, but there are a lot of different foreclosure laws throughout the country. I mean, there are many states that give people no redemption period. They're not judicial. Basically, you send the borrower a notice that they're in default, and within a short period of time, you sell their property.
But that wouldn't have helped here.
That wouldn't have helped here, but that helps with the blight and the abandonment issue. Or if the foreclosure had occurred back in 2008 when Mrs. Carlson was originally in default, that would have helped, but they tried to work out.
Force the bank to foreclose immediately or within 3 months after there's no payment?
I'm sorry.
You want legislation that forces the bank to foreclose at a particular time after the party has not fully paid up?
No, I don't think that doesn't embody the policy that Wisconsin has to allow people to redeem the property. There was two loan modification agreements that was both in 2009 and 2008 to try to allow her to retain her property.
On April 24th, 2011, the bank filed a default judgment and got a default judgment.
Right.
And that default judgment, as I understand it, was drafted by the bank, and it said the bank has a duty to inspect and maintain the property under the ordinance, and the default judgment ordered sale. So why don't you fulfill the default judgment that the bank itself drafted?
It also indicated that it would be sold any time after 3 months. There wasn't a specific time frame. And within a very short period of time, several weeks, the vandals broke in and burned down the garage. I don't think anybody could have foreseen that. And when you reduce the value of the property, again, the foreclosure statute was designed to help people retain the property, not force the lenders to take the property. So I'm not suggesting that it is appropriate to change the statute so you're in default, you're out. I'm just saying these are very competing policy issues that all over the country they're wrestling with.
Counselor, you know, I read the Court of Appeals decision a little bit differently than you do. I think that the circuit court refused to order a sale because it didn't think it had the power to do that under the statutes. And I think the Court of Appeals decision said, you may order it, so you have the power. I didn't read it as directing that a sale must follow when it goes back to the circuit court. And I'm wondering, you know, with properties like this, the city could easily take it in a summary proceeding on the taxes that are due. And since they're raising this property, maybe all of those things are things that need to be brought to the circuit court if it goes back down, knowing it has the power to order a sale but is not required to order the sale. Would that displease you if we concluded it had the power but was not required?
I think that that is something that the court under appropriate circumstances could consider, because that there's nothing that says when the sale has to occur in the statute, so that's something that the equitable discretion could be versus ordering the lender to buy it, because the statute's pretty explicit that if they want to, they can credit bid. But I also think then it does need to go back to the circuit court, because the circuit court did not get to that issue. They had moved to reopen the judgment on equitable grounds a year and a half after the judgment was entered. So I think that that's where the court would have to direct the trial court to go back and revisit the issue. And I do think that there are issues as to will the, you know, city of Milwaukee take less in property taxes to try to find somebody. The problem here is not forcing a sale. It's finding a buyer, a good quality buyer. I know that there are recent discussions with the city of Milwaukee and other neighborhood groups to try to go in and buy some of these properties to give people a chance at home ownership, which is also a very strong policy.
I know, but who's putting up the money? Isn't the city of Milwaukee putting up some money to do that?
It would, and it also does have some cost in raising the property. But remember, the lender did lose $50,000. We're not asking for a deficiency. We're satisfied our mortgage. So they've lost money in the situation as well.
Well, as I read your brief, you don't want to be ordered to buy the property, and as I read your brief, you don't want a discretion in the court, to trial court, to order you to buy. Your brief, as I understand it, says no, nothing under the statute. Is that correct?
It says definitely no, and my light, red light is on, but I'd like
may respond.
It says no, you. The statute, the way it's read, doesn't require a sale at any particular time.
Does it empower a trial court to order a sale?
I think under appropriate circumstances, which were not decided in this situation, I think it could order a sale, but then you end up with then that might be the same in the situation where a person is living in a house. And lenders then may try to say, okay, we are definitely going to sell a property, even though the person's trying to. There's flip sides to everything, is all I'm saying, is that it's got to be equitable discretion based on the facts of the particular case. It's not a one-size-fits-all.
I know, but maybe that's the way to interpret this statute, so that it protects both you, the mortgagee, and the mortgagor. But you don't think that's the correct interpretation, as I understand it, and you don't think that's what the Court of Appeals did.
I don't think that's what the Court of Appeals did.
And you don't think that's not the interpretation you're arguing for?
We were focused on the Court of Appeals as saying shall. The Court has raised a good point. I think in appropriate circumstances, if the Court decides after hearing from both sides that a sale should be ordered. The other factor here, though, is the sheriff. Their schedules, when they organize sales, I mean, there has to be a... It can't be immediately upon 5 weeks or whatever, but in appropriate circumstances that this case never got to, it might be one solution. But again, you can order the sale, but you can't order a buyer.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hartman representing Ms. Carson. You can lower that podium, Ms. Hartman, so that... No, doesn't lower. Okay. You can stand.
Okay.
You can stand tall, then. No, you have to do one or the other. Okay. Go ahead.
I'm standing as tall as I possibly can. May
but
it please
we
the
can
court?
Hear. We can hear you.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is April Hartman from Legal Action Senior Law, and I represent Shirley Carson. I first just want to clarify a few things that were raised during the initial argument. In our opinion, the Court of Appeals decision was one about the Circuit Court's authority to order a sale under 846.102. And the issue of whether it was equitable to enter that order or whether we had grounds under 806.07, those issues were not reached by the Circuit Court because the Circuit Court said that it did not have the authority to order the sale. And so that's our position, that the Court of Appeals decision is that the Circuit Court has the authority.
But is it required to order, or does the Circuit Court have discretion whether to order, or isn't that clear in the Court of Appeals, or isn't that before us?
I think that the Court of Appeals decision did not say that the Circuit Court had to order the sale, that the Court of Appeals decision was just saying that it had the authority. I think that the statute, 846.102, directs the court, if the court finds that the property is abandoned, applying all the criteria in the standard, to enter judgment of foreclosure and to provide that the property, that sale of the property shall be made upon the expiration of 5 weeks. So I think the statute is pretty clear that if the court finds abandonment, that's what the court needs to order. I also think, however, that plaintiffs in this situation have available to them the same relief through 806.07 that we took advantage of. And so there is room at the circuit court level for discretion about what to do in these cases. And there's also the court's equitable authority to balance the equities in any foreclosure situation. So while I think the Court of Appeals decision was about just the authority, and while I think the statute directs the court to enter the order, I think the circuit court is still left with a lot of discretion about what to do next, as are the parties.
Are you arguing that the mortgagee, the bank, must buy the property?
No, we have never said that. I don't think that's part of this case. It might come up in a future case, but that is not our position here. The statute says that sale shall be made. In our mind, that means that the property shall be brought to sale, not that the mortgagee has to buy the property.
Well, counsel, I'm not quite understanding how 806.07 modifies what you say 846.102 requires of the court or directs the court.
I don't think that it modifies 846.102. I just think that it's a tool that's available to parties in litigation if the court were to enter a judgment of foreclosure under 846.102, or if we were talking about, as in this case, where there's already a judgment of foreclosure entered and somebody's seeking, a party or the city of Milwaukee is seeking an amended order. I think 806.07 is just a tool that's available to the plaintiff to say, we want out of this case, we want out of this judgment, and it's no longer equitable that the, if there is a current judgment, that the judgment has prospective enforcement power, or they can argue that under all the circumstances, it's not just for the order to be in place or the order to continue.
The plaintiff here being the bank?
Yeah, the plaintiff here being the bank. So 806.07 is available to both parties in litigation. So if a judgment has been entered, either the plaintiff or the defendant can seek relief from that judgment.
Would a motion under 806.07 by the bank always be granted?
No, it would not always be granted. And so, again, that would bring the situation back to the discretion of the circuit court, which is in a really good position to understand the situation, to hear the testimony from the parties and the city of Milwaukee or other communities that want to come in and talk about this and to decide what to do next.
Let's assume you win this case. What are going to be the economic consequences of that?
Well, what we hope to have as the consequences of that, what I think that this case means, is that lenders will think and investigate all the facts and determine the remedy they seek before they file foreclosure litigation. So that's the number one effect that we're hoping that this case has. Also, that they would communicate better with their borrowers, and also the court might communicate better with the borrowers at the circuit court level, to inform them of their rights and their responsibilities and liabilities as defendants in foreclosure actions or as borrowers regarding continuing to live in the property and maintain the property while the foreclosure proceedings are ongoing. And I also think that it will make real estate in the city of Milwaukee more alienable. It will clear up some clouded title issues because even when the mortgage is satisfied and the Liz Pendens is released, if the judgment is not satisfied, there's a foreclosure judgment hanging over this property. And people like Shirley Carson are not going to be able to get a title insurance company to say yes to the sale of a property when there's a foreclosure judgment hanging over its head. And Bank of New York is asserting its right to continue to enforce that foreclosure judgment to up to 5 years while the property sits abandoned. So they're not going to be able to get title insurance. They're not going to be able to get a real estate agent to come and work and try to sell the property. And they're not going to find a buyer who's willing to buy. So those are the effects that we hope this case will have and that we think it will have.
Are you sure that the banks are going to be lending the money in the first place?
Well, no, I'm not. So the banks may reconsider some of their lending practices. This loan originally came from Countrywide, and I think that we would benefit. So Countrywide doesn't exist anymore, but from more careful lending considerations, I think that society as a whole benefits from that. I mean, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Not sure that's been the consistent philosophy over the years.
Counsel,
yes, Bradley.
Thank you, Chief. Counsel, you make reference to 806.07. And what part of 806.07 are you referring to? That statute, of course, deals with relief from a judgment or order.
Right. So I'm talking about 806.07, I believe it's sub 1, G and H.
G reads, it's no longer equitable that the judgment should have prospective application, or H, any other reasons justifying relief. Now, I was afraid you were going to say H because I always have thought H is really squishy. And, you know, you can do anything you want under H, and I guess I like things a little tighter and more regulated with kind of a formula and elements to consider. And my concern when I say
squishy, and I mean that, is that H could potentially be used to not just relieve someone from judgment, but undermine the legislative language of shall. If not in this particular case, in a different type of case. I am concerned about using H to really pull the guts out of a statute that has that uses the word shall. What's your response to that? I cannot quickly think of another context where the court has shall vis-a-vis entering a judgment or entering something like a sale. But let's say there is, and I just have a poverty of imagination this afternoon. And so, doesn't it just swallow the rules, swallow the legislative intent of using a mandatory word when you say, oh, yeah, but there's 806.07, and really, Judge, you can do anything you want? Can you respond to that?
Well, I think there are standards for when a circuit court has erroneously exercised its discretion, and that those issues could be raised in these cases if the use of H starts to undermine 846.102. So you do have to show that you have to show that your relief from the judgment is justified. And that's a decision, a discretionary decision to be made by the circuit court, but there is a standard there. So I think the Legal Aid Society's amicus brief talks quite a bit about what's happening now, where lenders are just sending in motions to reopen or relief from judgment without really proving that justice requires this relief. And that is an issue. But I do think that circuit courts with guidance can be trusted to determine whether there are reasons that justify relief.
You also cite to G, which at least has something, and that is, in my mind, it is no longer equitable that the judgment should have prospective application. Tell me why that fits to your fact situation.
Well, that would fit in, I think, in a couple different scenarios. So it might fit in where a motion under 846.102 is brought, and the bank responds by bringing a motion under 806.07, seeking to reopen the current judgment. So in a case like Carson, there's already a foreclosure judgment in place, and we're seeking to amend it to comply with 846.102. And so a bank might respond to such a motion by filing a motion under 806.07 sub G and saying, we want, instead of this hearing, instead of this judgment being entered, we would like the court to reopen and dismiss this foreclosure case because it's no longer equitable given the condition of the property or given the status of the property, the unlikelihood of sale, whatever reasons the bank wants to list, for this order to continue to have prospective application. And then the second scenario might be a case where a property like Carson is brought to sale under 846.102 and isn't sold at the sale. And then what practically happens is that the property is just signed up for the next sale. That's what the sheriff does. It just keeps trying to sell the property until it's sold. But if that happens repeatedly and if the property is not sold at that point, 806.07 sub G might come into play for the bank.
What confuses me here is, suppose you should prevail, and I gather you think that the trial court on a finding of abandonment would then exercise its discretion whether to force that a sale occur, right?
That's not exactly what I think. I think that if the trial court finds abandonment, if it hears this motion and finds abandonment, then the statute directs it to order judgment and to order that the property shall be
put
to
sale. It's not discretionary.
Right.
Mandatory.
Right.
Okay. Well, then you agree with the Bank of New York. They thought that's what the statute would might be interpreted as, and that would not be appropriate. Now, and that would violate Matson. Look,
if Bank of New York never foreclosed, right, your client would remain the owner, right?
Well, for a period of time. So if Bank of New York never foreclosed, my client would remain the owner, but the likely outcome would be probably an eventual tax foreclosure by the city or some other action that the taxpayers have to pay for. Because my client is simply in a situation where she could not continue to live in the property and maintain it.
So there could be a tax foreclosure by the city, or there could be a raising of the property, right?
There could be. Actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think there's some confusion. This is not part of the record, and so I can clarify, look into this and send the court a letter, but I think the raise order on the property was for the garage only. I don't think the city is preparing to raise the house.
Okay, so how does it help the owner if there's a tax foreclosure instead of a judgment foreclosure?
It doesn't help the owner, and it hurts everybody else. So it hurts the community, because tax foreclosures and then the future ownership by the city hurts all the taxpayers in the city. It's very expensive.
Well, I think the cities do it on a routine basis. In fact, they did one in Dane County a few years back where they foreclosed on a very, very nice house and sold it for considerably more than the taxes. But they were ahead of everybody, and nobody wanted to defend against the summary proceedings. I think if the city's going to clear this up, they're going to have to do something. But, you know, that's not for us to decide. If it goes back to the circuit court can decide what the equities require. That's not where we are here. We're just looking at the statute and whether the circuit court has the power to order a sale, or whether they have no power to order the sale, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't see whether you, if you force a sale in foreclosure, or, and if you did that, then the bank just wouldn't foreclose. Your client is in the same position. Would lose the property and have the duty of maintenance.
So it's a different situation. First of all, so the statute, 846.102, is really meant to serve the public. So it's not so much meant to serve my client, Shirley Carson, as it is meant to ensure that properties don't sit mired in the foreclosure process abandoned. But additionally, when the tax foreclosures happen, first of all, they don't happen right away. They take a long time to happen. I think in the city of Milwaukee, it takes like 3 to 5 years of being behind in your taxes before the property is actually foreclosed. But then once they happen very quickly. In this situation, Ms. Carson has a property that is a zombie because it has this foreclosure judgment hanging over it. And nobody's interested in maintaining it, buying it, doing anything with it. So I guess that's the difference. But also, the statute is very clearly meant to serve the public and to protect the public from what happens when these properties in foreclosure sit abandoned and deteriorating, the increase in crime, fires, decrease in property values. That's what 846.102 is about. And that's there in the plain language of the statute, and not just in the use of the word shall. Although this court has, in the foreclosure context, this court, not the Court of Appeals in the Matson cases, has interpreted shall to be mandatory. So in the GMAC versus Giswold case, this court talked at length, that's 215 with 2D 459, this court talked at length about how the use of shall in the foreclosure statutes was mandatory, and kind of compared the use of the word shall with the use of the word may. And that's in paragraphs 32 through 35. And then again, in Bank Mutual versus S.J. Boyer Construction Incorporated, in the context of ordering a judgment for deficiency, this court said that shall means automatically follows by operation of law. So this court has looked at the definition of the word shall, but the plain language of 846.102 is much more than just the word shall, because it includes subsection 2. And the only way that subsection 2 has any meaning or isn't completely superfluous is if the cities like City of Milwaukee can come in and present evidence to the court of abandonment, and the court then has the authority to order that the property be brought to sale. And in addition, 846.102 is very different from 846.103 and the other statutes, foreclosure statutes, because it doesn't use the word plaintiff at all. So 846.103 and 846.101 talk about the plaintiff's right to benefit from the statute and to reduce the redemption period and kind of control the timing of sale. 846.102, the shortened redemption period and the timing of the sale is based only on the condition of the property. That was the legislature's only concern. And we can look at the recent testimony. I mean, if this court, so that's a plain language argument, and the Court of Appeals agreed that the plain language provided that the court had the authority to order the sale. But if this court found that language ambiguous at all, it could just look at the recent testimony that was before the legislature when they created subsection 2. When they were considering 2000 Wisconsin Act 136, the city of Milwaukee, which was a huge proponent of the act, testified before the legislature that reducing the amount of time properties sit vacant is a critical goal of our city officials. And they specifically brought to the legislature's attention the problem of walkaway servicers. So that's really telling when Bank of New York's argument is that the statute is only meant to serve them so that if they want to, they can sell the property sooner. This act was meant to address the problem of walkaway servicers. And then the Bankers Association said that that the purpose of the statute was to address abandoned properties before they spiral out of control and cause great damage to both the neighborhood and the community as a whole. So that was the Bankers Association's take on the act. And they noted that the bill gave the city authority and should reduce the city's costs and should speed up the process during which the foreclosed property goes from being a blight on the city to a kept-up owner-occupied home.
Was it your interpretation that after the five-week period ends, that's when there should be a sale and under the statute?
My interpretation of the statute, and what I think the Court of Appeals was also saying, is that the property shall be brought to sale without delay, meaning within a reasonable time after the expiration of the redemption period. So we are not arguing that the word immediately needs to be inserted into the statute or that the sale needs to be brought on the 36th day. That's not what we're saying. It's within a reasonable time after the redemption period has expired. And again, the circuit court is in the best position to determine whether a reasonable time period has passed and whether the plaintiff is acting contemptuously or whether there's a legitimate reason that the sale isn't happening right away after the 5 weeks have expired.
The theory is that if it's done promptly, that is, the sale is done promptly, there'd be less decay of the property and more easily saleable.
Yes. So Ms. Carson's property was starting to deteriorate before she moved out, but as time went on, as the property sat, things got worse and worse. There was the fire, there was the trash, there were vandals who broke in. And so the sooner these properties are sold, the sooner they are no longer drained on local government resources, and the sooner that they're owner-occupied, the sooner that the less waste is likely to occur. So,
You write this opinion if you would prevail? I guess you don't necessarily agree with the Court of Appeals. If you interpret the Court of Appeals to say it's totally discretionary with the trial court whether the sale has to be done.
I think that I do agree with the Court of Appeals that the court has the authority to order that the property be sought for sale. But, I don't think that the circuit court actually reached a decision regarding what happens next. I don't think the Court of Appeals really talked about what happens next.
Court of Appeals sent this down for decision on abandonment and find out exactly what they did. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think they sent it down for the circuit court to make findings related to abandonment. And I do agree with the Court of Appeals, if what they are saying is that If the circuit court finds that the property is abandoned, then it must enter a judgment and it must order that the sale shall be made upon the expiration of 5 weeks. I do agree with the Court of Appeals that's what the statute says and that's what it directs the circuit court to do. Where I think the discretion comes in is what is a reasonable time after the expiration of the redemption period for the sale to be made. That's because the way that we believe this statute is enforced is the way that orders are enforced in court through contempt proceedings. So,
but you talk about bringing the property to sale. You don't think that the bank has any obligation to buy when it comes. So if nobody shows up, the bank has satisfied what they're supposed to do, correct?
Yes. I mean, it's an ongoing obligation. So I wouldn't say that you just have one sale and you quit and go back and say, but yes, then if nobody bids, then we're all back in court talking to the circuit court about what's going to happen next. And does the bank want to continue to try to bring the property to sale, or does the bank want to file a motion under 806.07 and dismiss this litigation and this cloud on the title that it's created? Mm-hmm. Yes. And so I think that...
So you'd be happy if the Supreme Court just adopted the Court of Appeals decision and said, hey, great decision, it's now ours.
Yes, I would be happy with that.
And you would interpret that to mean that the trial court, if it found abandonment, forces a sale within a reasonable time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And I would leave it up to the parties or the communities like the City of Milwaukee to determine whether they're going to bring motions for contempt, you know, whether they think that too long has gone by. And then I would leave it to the circuit court to determine whether a reasonable time has passed after the redemption period, whether the plaintiff is being obstructive willfully, or whether this is just the natural result of complicated foreclosure proceedings.
Does legal action Wisconsin ever represent banks?
No, we do not.
Why not?
You don't care about banks?
Legal Action of Wisconsin provides representation to people who could not otherwise afford representation, and I think that the banks are able to afford representation, it appears.
So even if banks had legitimate concerns, you wouldn't be representing them?
That's true.
Okay. Do you think banks have any concerns about your interpretation of the statute? Legitimate concerns?
I think that banks may not like that the legislature can force them to finish the litigation that they've started, and that the legislature can require the court to enter a judgment over the objections of the banks. I think they may not like that. But the legislature has chosen to do that. It's chosen to implement 846.102, and it's chosen to protect interests other than the bank's interests. And certainly when we look at what happens, what's a result of these abandoned properties, the legislature has a very strong interest in protecting communities' health and safety by ensuring that abandoned properties go to sale as quickly as possible. And so that's all we're asking this court to do. We're just asking the court to give 846.102 its full proper intended effect, what the legislature intended when it enacted the statute and what it clearly was considering when it enacted 2011 Wisconsin Act 136.
How do you distinguish Mattson?
Oh. So Mattson, I think, is very distinguishable from Carson in that they involve different statutes. Mattson did not raise 846.102, didn't argue it, didn't talk about the purpose that 846.102 has or the difference between the language in 846.103 and 846.102, where 846.103 talks about the plaintiff and 846.102 talks about communities coming in and intervening in foreclosure actions. So there's that. And procedurally, they were different, and that was important to the Court of Appeals. Mattson just sought to enforce orders that said that the property may be sold at any time after the expiration of the redemption period, and Maxon was seeking contempt findings against the bank for violating those orders. And I think the Court of Appeals didn't think that the plaintiffs were in contempt of those orders because this order said the property may be sold at any time. In Carson, I filed a motion to amend the order because we had the same order and brought evidence of abandonment to the circuit court that complied with the factors in 846.102, and I sought an order that told the banks what to do, which was that they shall bring the property to sale upon the expiration of the redemption period. And I know that that was important to the Court of Appeals because the Court of Appeals in the second Maxon decision pointed out that Maxon did not seek to reform the judgment but sought to enforce it as written. That's in paragraph 17. And also Maxon framed the question. The second Maxon decision purposely narrowed the question to whether a particular foreclosure judgment mandates a sheriff's sale.
So Maxon dealt with interpreting a particular judgment, in your opinion, not the statute.
In my opinion, yes. So the ultimate holding of Maxon was about that particular foreclosure judgment. Definitely the Maxon decisions did cite the shall be brought to sale language in 846.103 and say that that did not mandate a sale. But they were doing it in the context of were these plaintiffs in contempt.
And here you try to avoid Maxon by seeking an amendment to the judgment.
Well, here, yeah, I think that distinguishes the two cases. I mean, our motion in Carson was brought before Maxon came out. But, yes, I think that does distinguish the two cases. I mean, not just amending the judgment, but raising 846.102 and talking about that statute's specific purpose to protect the community. So in conclusion, I just say we're asking the court to give 846.102 its full proper intended effect by finding that it does grant the court the authority to order that an abandoned property in foreclosure proceedings be brought to sale upon the expiration of the 5-week redemption period. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the Bank of New York.
Thank you, Your Honor. In this case, the argument is the Bank of New York shouldn't have foreclosed. If it did, it has to go through it. But if it didn't foreclose, we'd be in the same position. Mrs. Carson would be in the same position. And there would still be a cloud on title because nothing would happen. She had moved out and abandoned the property. If in this case we were ordered to sell the property, there's nothing that prohibits a lender from satisfying their judgment. You don't have to move to vacate. The judgment may be satisfied by signing by the owner or the attorney of record, acknowledging that you're no longer claiming an interest in the property or the foreclosure judgment. So, again, we would be in the same place. If we brought the foreclosure judgment and were forced to continue to try to sell the property, we're in the same place. No one buys it. She's still the owner because under Wisconsin law, it's clear she's the owner to a confirmation hearing. And you're just increasing the expense and the time. As a practical effect, this is a unique case because Mrs. Carson had abandoned the property prior to the foreclosure action, and understandably so because she realizes she couldn't keep up the property. Most people will stay in the property, so once you start the foreclosure action, when they abandon the property is after the redemption period is over or close to being over. So if you're ordered to sell the property immediately upon a determination that the property is abandoned, banks would start a foreclosure action, the redemption period would run, the people would abandon the property, and then at that point move to have it a finding of abandonment, and the court must order the sale. And so during that period of time, taxes aren't being paid, the property is probably not being maintained, the mortgage isn't being maintained. So that doesn't help the whole abandonment issue. There are solutions, and the state and the city have other ways to raise property, to condemn property, to deal with blight issues. I'm not saying they're perfect. Nothing in this world is perfect. I'm just saying that trying to fit a square peg in a round hole doesn't solve the problem. And if you look at the language of the statute, merely because a property is abandoned doesn't force a sale. The shall relates to the redemption period. And again, that goes back to 1840, and Wisconsin has some of the longest redemption periods in the country. And that's for a reason. It's because it's trying to protect the people that are in the houses. Again, you have one case. It's changing the law based on the facts of one case, I think, have unintended consequences that need to be addressed in a bigger context somewhere else.
Well, if the court, whatever the court holds, the banking industry, which has a significant interest in this, right, especially with, 4,000 properties in, is it foreclosure or default?
There are 4,800 that are abandoned. Only 400 are in foreclosure.
Okay. So you got 400. That's still a lot, and there may be more coming. Banking industry is going to go to the legislature to fix it up.
Or they're just not going to foreclose, which would be the easiest way, or they're going to satisfy their mortgage. And then that doesn't solve the problem.
No, and you still have the issue, which is not before us, of the debt. We had a case recently, I think last, must have been issued in June or July, that said that the debt and the mortgage were intertwined, and one followed the other.
That's true. You release the mortgage, the note may still be alive, but the mortgage, if you release the note, the mortgage is gone.
Mm-hmm. So here, they didn't release the note, so there's still a debt, and that's been sold and maybe resold, right?
There was no request for a deficiency judgment, so the note and mortgage merge into that foreclosure judgment because they're not independent notes and mortgages. So the note is gone, the mortgage is gone.
Okay, so you did have a merge.
Right.
All right. Thank you. It was not clear in the briefs. Sorry.
How long could the bank continue, in your theory, to do nothing?
Like other execution judgments, they typically last for about 5 years, and then they're void unless there's an application to renew them. I suspect what would happen is the tax sale would occur before that because the city taxes trump everything else. So I think there could also be an argument for latches if it was longer than that.
What exactly is the issue here? Is it that 846-102 requires a sale, or that 846-102 permits the court to have some authority to deal with the problem?
The red light's on. I would like to...
Absolutely.
The issue here is if you read 846-102 to say, upon a finding of abandonment, you must sell the property, that's the issue. If you say, because what will happen is people will be in the property, then when they leave it, they'll come back in and say, it's abandoned, you must sell the property so I don't have to be responsible. If you're saying 846-102 allows court equitable discretion in certain circumstances to determine when a property should be sold, not force the buyer to buy it, but to say not force the lender to buy it, but say, sell this, try to sell this property once, twice, whatever, then I don't see the issue. The concern was in Arch Bay, the court not only said sell this property, which the bank did take it to sale, but then when nobody bought it, the court said go back and sell it again.
court back, the lender went back and sold it again and bought it for a dollar because nobody else wanted it. And then the court tried to hold them in contempt and sanctioned their counsel for speaking because they had not bought the property at a reasonable amount. I think that's underlying the concern.
What was Arch Bay, 846-102 or 846-103?
That one was, it was a, let me grab the case. I know it was,
I thought that was an unpublished opinion, and you got it in your,
it was
in your appendix. Arch Bay is at A45 of your appendix.
Right. I have the case here. It was a vacant property, and there was citation for building code violations. I'm not sure ultimately, and it doesn't really matter because if it was abandoned and vacant, it's abandoned property. That covers both commercial property and homestead property. So the whole point of it was it was abandoned.
Okay. So as I understand your argument in answer to Justice Prosser is 846-102 does not require a sale of the property. Your alternative argument is if the court doesn't accept that, that the most 846-102 permit, 102 says, is the trial court has equitable discretion to order a sale after a finding of abandonment.
Correct. And not just because it's abandoned.
I understand that, but that's where the equitable discretion. Look at everything. That's your second position. Your first one is no sale required. Bank can sit on it for as long as it wants unless there's something else that comes up.
The 5 years or until the legislature changes the statute.
Yeah. The Arch Bay was 846-1032. The language in the foreclosure judgment substantially follows the relevant statute 846-103, under which Arch Bay elected to seek foreclosure. So that was an 846-1032, and that's where the court interpreted or reinterpreted, however you see it, Mattson. Okay. But do you think the two are the same, 846-102 and 846-102?
Well, the language is identical, and if the court holds the abandonment statute means what the respondent is trying to do, everybody's going to bring it under that section to try to get out of the other section's language. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Well, I don't hear any further questioning, so you may be seated. Counsel, I want to thank on behalf of the court counsel for both the Bank of New York and Shirley T. Carson for their briefs in this case and their oral argument on a matter that has not, as far as I know, directly previously come to the court. And the court will, of course, take this under advisement and deal with the issue. That concludes the hearing in 13AP 544, Bank of New York versus Carson. Now, because I can't read that clock, what time is it?
1:45. 1:45. 1:45.
Back at 1:30.
Marsha, would you call the parties and see that in the next case whether they can come for oral argument at 2 instead of 1:30. If that's inconvenient for one reason, we'll do it at 1:30. But if it's convenient that they come at 2 or 2:15, then advise the court. Okay? We are in recess until the